Welcome to Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You may have heard the promos for our show today and thought, Lyndon Johnson, why are we having a discussion about this man who hasn't been in the White House in 50 years and died 45 years ago? Why today? Why have this conversation? Well, there are two reasons. For one, it is the 55th anniversary of the University of Michigan speech in which Johnson gave a name to the sweeping legislation he envisioned after President Kennedy's death. But more to the point, I keep noticing the debates that are playing out on social media, cable television, the editorial pages. These are debates about immigration, natural resources, economics, government regulation, public education, and that's just a few. Those are all debates that connect back to legislation from the Great Society period. I think very few people in my generation are aware of that. Maybe you're not. So what we'd like to do today is provide context to give all of us an idea that what we think may be unique to our moment is in fact just the latest chapter in a longer national dialogue that's been going on in some form or another since at least 1964 and probably a good deal before that as well. Joining us on the program today are Robert Wilson. He is the Distinguished Visiting Professor in the Department of Public Policy and Interim Director of the Sustainable Global Cities Initiative at the University of Connecticut. In 2015, he and two colleagues co-edited the book LBJ's Neglected Legacy. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Brandon. It's a pleasure. Appreciate the invitation.
Well, thank you for being with us. And Aaron Astor joins me in the studio. He's about 3 feet away from me, not in Connecticut, as Bob is today. Associate Professor of History at Maryville College, Aaron teaches a class called The Long 1960s, which looks at the political and cultural shifts of the period 1954 to 1979. He's been a guest with us before here on WUOT to talk about the history and evolution of the Appalachian Regional Commission, which, again, came from the Great Society legislation. Dr. Astor, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, gentlemen, I'd like to set the stage for the discussion, talking about maybe where this came from. Aaron, you and I were talking about this actually before we came on today, that this broadening of governmental authority and different areas of governmental activity in places where it hadn't been before, like education, that we call the Great Society, this collective term for a package of legislation, actually traces its roots to the early 20th century, to about Teddy Roosevelt and the Progressive Era. How did we get from there to Johnson in the 60s?
Good question. I think we have to see it in terms of cycles of expansion and contraction of the federal government, the scope and role of the federal government throughout much of the first half of the 20th century. The Progressive Era, most famously, things like the Food and Drug Act, which have still to this day have enormous significance on our food safety and pharmaceuticals and all of that. And of course, there were various acts that were struck down by the Supreme Court at the time, but this resulted in a pretty substantial change in the scope of the federal government in peacetime, and that's worth stressing here. In the 1920s, of course, there was a movement away from that after 1919, 1920, and then with the New Deal in the 1930s, there was another wave of expansion of federal government intervention in the financial services industry, in particular agriculture, the old age insurance, the Social Security Act, labor. So it was a whole new category, and also the beginnings of art of the arts, the Works Progress Administration, for example, murals and those kinds of things that were now funded by the federal government. And then you had, once again, a somewhat of a contraction with World War II and the post-World War II period into the late 40s and into the 50s. And so here in 1960, 61, President Kennedy comes in and talks once again about this reinvigoration of a federal government purpose of expanding and addressing all kinds of needs that have been largely unaddressed. Of course, the context then was one of prosperity rather than grinding poverty of the 30s, although it was really a matter of who's being left out of this prosperity of the early 1960s when Kennedy first introduced his domestic agenda.
Bob, I want to turn to you for a moment. Each of the pieces of Great Society legislation had specific goals. Some were civil rights, some were desegregation, voting rights, funding for higher education, elementary, secondary education, and so on. But broadly, if you can do so, broadly, what were Lyndon Johnson's goals for the Great Society? What did he have in mind for this whole raft of legislation?
I think primarily he saw himself finishing the work that had been started by Roosevelt in the 1930s. And this, if you can see, it dates back a little bit earlier, as the Astor just said. But there's a vision that the purpose of government is to make a better country, to make a better world, to benefit people in the country. And there are a whole variety of ways in which that can happen. So we see here government as a force of good, as an actor. And a lot of things were tried with under Roosevelt, and as Esther just said, many of those things were kind of turned back over the following decades. And Johnson had the opportunity to take up that baton again, and I think that was his goal. Things like eliminating poverty. Why is it the wealthiest country in the world had poverty? Why is it the United States still had second-class citizens in the African-American population? So he saw his federal government as a force of good. And the other thing that he did in extending the range of things that Roosevelt's talked about is the concept of modernizing the administration of the federal government, I think, is an important element here. The introduction of things like the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Transportation, a whole range of changes in federal government that would align the federal government more in, to the needs of a growing, prosperous industrial society. So his task that he set for himself was to take advantage of the position he was in. He responded to some of the forces that were at work at that period of time, but he wanted to change the face of America. And even though, if you're moving forward a little bit, even though you don't see many instances where there his legislation, the Great Society legislation, remains intact, in fact, some elements have pretty much disappeared, many of the primary debates, the primary political fights we have are linked to his legacy. And I think it's the premise of your show today, I think, is right on target.
Well, the size and scope of federal government we talked about, this was Lyndon Johnson's lever. There's that old saying, you give me a lever long enough and I can move the world. His idea of the lever was the federal government. That's what he was in charge of. The size and the scope of the federal government, though, in this country has been a topic of debate going back to, what, Jefferson and Hamilton, you know, and probably even further than that. So this has always been a controversial topic, and Aaron, we can start with you, but I'd like to get both of your opinions on this. Whatever the individual goals of the specific pieces of legislation we'll talk about in some more detail shortly, that maybe the biggest general impact of Johnson's agenda was just in redefining what that scope of the federal government was.
Right. The federal government has had moments of expansion, but usually temporary and associated with war. So the American Civil War, for example, or World War I, or even the Second World War, where you had a dramatic expansion, but it was sort of in a moment of emergency, and it's always understood to be temporary. You know, interestingly enough, the Cold War creation of the permanent national military establishment in 1947 in some ways paved the way for a permanent apparatus, large-scale federal apparatus that would affect not only wartime and war preparation, but also peacetime, peace functions. And so you have the pieces in place, certainly continuing things like TVA, for example, from the 1930s, and various, you know, financial services legislation and agriculture legislation. But this is there already has been an expansion of the federal government, but this is really taking it to the next level. And certainly, you know, this was the main critique of Barry Goldwater in 1964, was that this was such a dramatic expansion of the federal government over not only the state but local governments and traditions, you know, traditional lines of authority, and that was that didn't resonate very strongly in 1964, but it would start to, especially when Ronald Reagan would take up that mantle much more in beginning in 1966 when Reagan ran for governor in California, but much further on as you got into the 1970s. Hmm. So it was the scope, the size of the federal government that certainly critics picked up on.
And Bob, what do you think of them?
I think it's also to put in the context of what the national challenges were. Aaron just pointed out we do have the threat of the Cold War and the Soviets and a whole range of things that not only Johnson did, but other presidents did, responded to that threat. The expansion of the federal government and basic research in this country is very much linked to the threat posed by the Soviet Union. So part of the expansion, I think, it responds to kind of national and global needs. Another example would be in the area of pollution. By the 1950s, air quality was bad, water quality was bad, and under the kind of the dual form of federalism in our Constitution, it would fall to the states to take care of these things. And we see any number of instances, at least in Johnson's mind, he was acting upon failures of state government. State government simply not taking the initiative to solve different kinds of problems, including Voting Rights Act. So part of this expansion of the scope, I think, is a response to real needs in the society. And also another very interesting footnote, some people argue that it was actually President Nixon was the last liberal president. And you'd note that he continued some of the more expansionary phases of the federal government, at least in setting national objectives, even though, and this is a real characteristic of Nixon and later Republicans, they relied on state governments to do more of the implementation of that. So contrasting Johnson and Nixon, both have national ambitions of federal policy to make the country better. Johnson really centralized in the federal government, and Nixon started a process of decentralizing some of this more to state governments, giving state governments more discretion. But it starts from the fact that, in Johnson's view and view of many Democrats, state governments were not fulfilling their responsibilities to the American public.
With that, we're going to take a station break. We're going to continue our conversation with Aaron Astor and Bob Wilson about the Great Society. You can submit your questions online. Go to Twitter at WUOTFM. You can also leave a message on our Facebook page on WUOT, and we'll open up the phone lines when we come back as well. Stay with us. Dialogue continues from WUOT News. Dialogue continues on this Wednesday afternoon. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth with you. Our guests today are Aaron Astor of Merivale College and Robert Wilson of the University of Connecticut. Today we're talking about the Great Society, then and now, Lyndon Johnson's ambitious legislative agenda for the country in the 1960s, and how it's shaping us today. We'll take your calls a little bit later on, 974-5500. Again, tweet us at WUOTFM, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page. And Aaron, as we start this second portion of the discussion, Bob was just talking about how there's an expansion of federal power. We've been talking about a lot in the first portion of our program today. But some of the Great Society programs were designed specifically with a state or local element in mind. I think of Medicaid, which is administered by states. I think of Head Start. I think of the Office on Aging, which all have local elements to them. The groundwork is being done at the community level. You thought of another example. That's the Office of Economic Opportunity, and there was a reason for that.
The Office of Economic Opportunity, and also particularly the community action programs with the community action agencies. The idea here was that you're supposed to circumvent, as Bob was talking about, a lot of this was driven by the failures of state government, and the most obvious were in opposing on civil rights matters. But there was a basic sense of corruption of state legislatures and municipal governments, which interestingly enough is exactly what progressives were concerned about in the 1890s, early 1900s.
That 50 years before.
Exactly. Yeah. So how do you circumvent that? Well, one way is, of course, through a professional bureaucracy, but that's the federal approach. But the other is the other direction, which is to go to the grassroots and to sort of provide funding for community grassroots organizations that will emerge, that will be able to respond to problems as they see fit. And this was quite popular for the first few years. Unfortunately, as sort of the inertia of the programs moved along, some of those programs started to become either swallowed up into the administrative inertia and functions of the bureaucracy, or just simply disappeared. But there was clearly, it was not just simply a matter of creating this large federal government entity to usurp the role of the state governments. It was also to go around it from the bottom up.
As many presidents have discovered, it's difficult to get anything done when Congress doesn't want to play ball. And this typically happens when you have a president of one party and the Congress controlled by another. We've seen a lot of that in our recent history here. Here's the contrast. One analysis from the Association of Centers for the Study of Congress counted that the 89th Congress, which met in 1965 and 66, approved 181 measures. 60 of them were considered landmark, and those did include some of the marquee pieces that we're talking about, like Medicare, federal funding for public schools, higher education, voting rights. That rate would be unheard of today. Bob, was it unusual during Johnson's day to see that kind of productivity too?
Yeah, I think you have to go all the way back to FDR to see similar levels of federal legislation, and it's one of the unique features of the Johnson period. And just to point out why he built upon, it had a long career in Congress and the Senate, particularly in the Senate, so he knew Washington very well. He knew how to operate in the Washington environment. He took advantage of deaths of important people, President Kennedy for one, but also Martin Luther King. You may recall that one of the principal reasons for getting the Housing Act passed in 1968 was happened soon after Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And then also you have the threat of the Soviet Union in the immigration law, the immigration reform of 1965. Johnson built upon the fact that the nation was in peril and threatened by the Soviet Union to secure that passage. So it is a remarkable period of legislation, progressive legislation, as I said before. Many elements have kind of disappeared, have been watered down, but it really was an extraordinary productive period. But we need to point out, he took advantage of his circumstance.
There was other
events going on, he probably would not have been nearly as successful.
That's an excellent point, too. I mean, we're talking about not just the product of the person, but the times in which he lived, which are unique to every president.
Right, and he did absolutely take advantage of the circumstances, the power arrangement of having Bent served as the master of the Senate and having such large majorities, particularly after the 1964 landslide.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the irony is that those events also overtook him. And undermined him. There's an inflection point, I think, around 1965. I think of the summer of 65, where you have this incredible spate of legislation, including the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid that's passed, and then you have the Watts riots. And then you have the ramp-up of Vietnam, which was technically a couple months earlier, the escalation. But you have this inflection point where you have Johnson seems to be going with the flow of this momentum of creating all this remarkable array of legislation on so many aspects of life. But then you start to see events start getting ahead of themselves. And I think one of the big challenges is there was a saying back then of the revolution of rising expectations, that people get angrier when they expect things to be better faster, and they don't get better faster enough. And so some of the frustrations that built in, seeing some of the progress elsewhere. Bob mentioned King's assassination in 68, but the Housing Act was also a result of King's march to Chicago in 1966, which tried to deal with the problems of discrimination in housing in the North, in northern
mm-hmm.
cities,
yeah.
where in many ways was more intractable. There was not an obvious target necessarily. I mean, it goes back to redlining laws back to the 1930s. And so here that frustration was stronger. The expectations that things would improve faster than they could or faster than they would. And that led to a lot of the upheaval that you saw, the long, hot summers.
And probably some disenchantment with the whole concept of the Great Society. Some backlash is like, well, it's not working 90 seconds down the road, so it's not working.
Exactly. And so he started to see this addressing of the symptoms. Well, we see the crime, you see the drugs, you see the riots, you see the breakdown of these cities. Well, we've thrown all this money at these cities, so therefore the problem must be something else. And there you see the germs of the new, the germination of a new conservative criticism, which is that the government programs themselves were the problem. That they were creating a culture of dependency that was undermining the traditional family order. And that would be beginning to be articulated in the Nixon years, but particularly taking off into the 80s.
Yeah. Bob, I want to turn back to you for a moment. We had a question that came in on Facebook from Olaf in Oak Ridge, who says, what were President Johnson's top three achievements? I know it may be hard to categorize that, but I want to put some specifics on. We've talked about concepts, but we haven't put too many names to these laws just yet. If you could think of like the three most effective or ones that have been strongest, kind of stood the test of time since the 60s, what would they be?
I think the war on poverty, and it is not successful, but I think as an important piece of legislation that kind of changed the discussion, I would say that was a key. The immigration policy, the immigration reform, unheralded at the time, has had extraordinary impact over time. And then probably the education reform that he introduced, primarily compensatory federal funding for poor students that are poor in public schools, I think had long-lasting effect. It is truly difficult to limit it to three. There are many. But I will offer those three.
Yeah, I certainly agree those are important. Medicare, certainly, which, LBJ saw as, and actually Kennedy really saw as completing what FDR had tried. I mean, there was so much poverty among the elderly population in the 1930s, and there still was persisting poverty and was almost entirely related to health issues.
Mm-hmm.
So Medicare was certainly important in the 60s. I would agree certainly on immigration and education. But I think environmental protection. I mean, we forget how much, how much environmental degradation was going on in the late 1960s, the Santa Barbara oil fire,
Cleveland,
this was the first sort of large scale attempt and successful attempt. And that was, in fact, continued by Nixon with the creation of the EPA. So that, I think, was another major long. But I mean, we can't forget the civil rights, the Civil Rights Act, but the entire the legislative architecture, the legal architecture of the Civil Rights Act, the concept of public accommodations and protected classes. I mean, we're still having debates about which protected classes are we including, what counts as public accommodations that are subject to civil rights acts. These are still extremely important and have fundamentally altered almost every aspect of American life.
And to continue along with specifics, and Bob, you alluded to this a moment ago, one area of major disagreement in politics and in public debate today is public education. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 provided the first substantial federal money to school systems. I did a little check, and in 2017, fiscal year 2017, Tennessee had $1.1 billion in education budget from the federal government. That's a not insubstantial amount. But that federal connection to education is both important and a common friction point in American politics even today.
A couple of points. Education is a really, really important topic in today's world. And education and poverty and desegregation were all tied up together. I think, if not Johnson himself, his advisors understood that where people live and their access to schools is a critical element for intermobility, generational intermobility. And so education was important, but it was also, the point is, our schools today are as segregated as they were back in the 1960s. So we've actually backtracked. Now, there's another interesting thing about the education reform. Johnson was very pragmatic in terms of the shape of public policy. Some policies like Medicare, Medicaid, were very, very poorly constructed, and why we have the mess we have today in part. But the really smart thing about compensatory education was school districts throughout the country that had poor kids would receive a transfer from the federal government. So really broad political support for that. There are lots of discussions about how effective it is and whether that those federal transfers can compensate for resegregation of public schools, and they can't. But it's really a very interesting way to think about those two dimensions: how we got it passed in the first place and why it's been sustained for so long, and then on the other hand, that our public school system is still haven't figured it out.
Yeah, and that's exactly close to the nexus of our conversation today, is that these debates were not resolved during the Johnson administration, and they haven't been resolved. We're still talking about them today. Aaron, before we came on the air, you mentioned something interesting and kind of a corollary law. So the one we just talked about, elementary and secondary education, applied to most K-12 schools. There was also a Higher Education Act that was passed around the same time, which put a huge influx of money into college campuses, and that resulted in a lot of, like, there was a building boom going on. Yeah. So you talked about some of the effects even here at the University of Tennessee that are visible to us today.
Yeah, I mean, one of the remarkable things you find at not only the University of Tennessee, but colleges and universities across the country, how many buildings were built in the 1960s. That was for
which
couple,
is not coincidental.
Which is not coincidental. It's for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, there already was an increase of college of students going to college, the baby boom generation, the GI Bill, but there was a massive expansion of support for tuition support, college loans that came out through a few acts of the 1960s, and not just to military veterans. And so you had, for all those reasons, a much larger student population, but you also had the direct construction of buildings that were in that period. And of course, in this building are not only hosting the communications department of the University of Tennessee, but National Public Radio, which is itself is a product of Public Broadcasting
Indeed.
Act, and public television, which were created also as part of the Great Society. But the building construction, today we sort of lament the architecture of the 60s, and many
True,
of these buildings
yeah.
by now are being have kind of passed their sell-by date anyway. But the tremendous expansion of colleges and universities, both in terms of campus size, facilities, as well as student body, was a major result of the Great Society.
The same budget year that I referenced just a moment ago, 2017, most of Tennessee's federal money was spent on healthcare and related programs. So $9.5 billion of our state budget came from federal programs. And that speaks to quality of life. These programs would include Medicare, Medicaid, which, as we said, is administered by the state of Tennessee with federal money, Head Start as well as through HHS. We would talk about, you know, dumping those. If you're talking about reducing those programs, you'd be talking about things that a lot of Tennesseans rely on and take for granted. And Bob, that gets to a key point that a lot of things we simply take for granted or assume to be there came from the Johnson administration's programs.
Yeah, that's right. It's part of the woodwork. Social Security to originate with, but there's Social Security reform and Medicare. I mean, you're absolutely right on that point. I think the Medicare, the whole health, national health policy, is a great way, a really useful lens to for a critique of how federal policymaking. As I've said a moment ago, Johnson was very pragmatic, and the health reform bill was very much reflects that pragmatism. There was various JFK had been interested in health reform. There was Medicaid, health care for poor people. There's the AMA, an extraordinarily strong actor in determining national health policy. So there's a lot of conflicting forces at work, and this is one area where it's real clear that Johnson had to negotiate with Congress. And the structure that we have, one program for the poor, we have another program for the elderly. Part of the idea here was, and this is another famous adage of LBJ, put laws on the book and then later modify them, later improve them. So it's more important to get even a bad piece of policy passed than it is to wait until you can get the perfect policy. So this is nowhere truer than the case of health care. Johnson, I think the Democrats, a lot of the architects of the policy, expected Medicare to eventually be expanded. And here we are 50 years later, and it's expanded a little bit. But more important, the compromise that Johnson had to make was the removal of cost containment of medical expenses, reimbursable medical expenses. And this was, if you kind of read through the transcripts and the historians that study this, this was clearly a compromise to get the bill passed. And one of the things that the AMA did not want was to have any caps on health spending. So at the time this was passed in the 1960s, I'm sure there's a lot of people said, that's okay, we'll fix it later. 50 years later, it hasn't been fixed. As we all know, this is the most expensive health care system in the country, and part of it is really a direct result of the kind of legislation that was passed in the 1960s.
Yeah, that's a great example of one of those flashpoints of modern political debate, because I know some of the Democratic candidates for president next year already they're invoking the name in Medicare for All or Medicare for America. They're linking back to this program, which many of us are familiar with or at least have heard of, that dates from the Johnson administration, and seeking for ways to change it, modify it, build on it in some way. There's a great example of what we're talking about today. We had another one, Aaron, you and I were talking about before we came on the air today, in environment and conservation. Here in East Tennessee, what, the National Trail System, Wild and Scenic Rivers, mm-hmm. National Wilderness Act, and that gives us what, OBED, Big South Fork, mm-hmm. some of the other areas that again, are our weekend getaways here in East Tennessee that simply didn't exist or didn't have the framework to exist before Great Society policies.
Right. That's one of the scopes that I think is the most surprising to a lot of people. And when I teach about the 1960s and the Great Society era, a lot of students are surprised. I mean, they've learned about Teddy Roosevelt and the National Park System in the early 20th century, mm-hmm. and the National Forest System. And they know about the EPA in 1970, the Clean Air Act, and Earth Day of 1970. But it's often forgotten how much of the legal architecture of not only the creation of these national parks, wilderness preservation areas, but also smog, fighting smog, all kinds of infrastructure support that are mm-hmm. supposed to try to balance both a smarter infrastructure with with less emissions. That's all coming out of the 1960s. And also, you know, connected to that is safety, traffic safety. I mean, you have the beginnings
mandatory seatbelts.
Mandatory seatbelts, yeah. Which, I mean, what's interesting about all these things is, as I've sort of mentioned them as they pop into the mind, is that they all seem to be connected to other pieces. There's a consumer aspect of it that's mm-hmm. being, safety, consumer safety. There's truth in advertising and truth in lending that all seem to be based around how corporations have behaved without any kind of guiding them, and how this is having deleterious effects on all different aspects of life.
And one that I like to remind people of when they're annoyed that they can't get into a medicine bottle, also childproof safety caps, right. Lyndon Johnson. That's so right. There you go. He gets the credit and the blame on that one. And let me say,
can I just add one point here? I think also the contribution to water quality during the Johnson period was really remarkable. Yeah. And the thing that was interesting about this, as I said before, was an example where state governments really did not do what they should have done to protect the quality of water. The federal government intervened, but the intervention was a federal-state collaboration that the federal government would help put in funds to clean up waterways, but state governments also had to match it. And in my mind, this is really an effective way to do public policy. So there is an element of a local buy-in in order to leverage the federal funds. And, you know, it has worked pretty well. You don't hear too much about a little bit. I know there's cutting back on some of the water quality regulations, but it's one that's become, as I said, part of the woodwork. It's the way we operate. We have a very productive, I think, federal-state legislation. I'm sure there's instances where state officials would argue vehemently with that point. But I think in broad measure, it was a very workable solution.
I should point out, too, again, echoes today where environmental groups sort of raised their eyebrows over the last couple of years when it was reported that the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, the state-level regulator, had issued, you know, fewer sanctions and had not gone after polluters under the Haslam administration. There was sort of more of a police yourselves kind of attitude. So again, here we have the question about what is the state's role, the federal role in this kind of thing? Where do they intersect? Where do they bump up against each other? Criticism of Great Society programs, we've talked a little bit about this from the conservative perspective, and obviously that would continue to rise up into Reagan's era when he famously said that government isn't the solution, it's the problem. And so that was articulated there, but there are also criticisms, I think, from the left as well. I remember, Dr. Astor, when you and I talked a couple of years ago about the Appalachian Regional Commission, that some of that criticism comes from the liberal or progressive side. Would you outline some of those criticisms?
Yeah, well, this is what I was trying to get at before about the community action plans and about the idea early on for many of these, particularly anti-poverty programs, was that grassroots organizations, community organizations, were supposed to have a real say in how this money was going to be administered. And the problem was that in practice didn't really happen for a variety of administrative reasons. Bob could probably speak to this a little more authoritatively, what happens in terms of the public policy, the administration of these policies. But in a lot of places, you had, I mean, model cities programs that went wrong. In fact, I know in Connecticut, New Haven is sort of cited as an example of one that didn't work. There was sort of this idea that you were going to fix these cities, and then whoever ended up being in control of these monies didn't really go to the people who really needed it, or it could be managed, could be held, say, captive by locally powerful groups, which of course happened in the New Deal as well. With agricultural grants in the Cotton Belt, for example. So this was people on the left were upset that the idea here of having grassroots control over a lot of these programs just never really was carried out in practice. Certainly, the Appalachian Regional Commission, we saw that. With these kinds of programs, and you add to that again the rising expectations, which is what led to more frustration. The expectations that things would be addressed, and when they weren't, with all this talk of hope, that led to a sort of almost a self-fulfilling prophecy of frustration and rage, frankly.
Bob, did you have anything to add on to that?
Yeah, those are really terrific points. I want to just say a couple of words about the Fair Housing Act of 1968 and fair housing. But before I say that, we need to remember also the anti-war movement was extraordinarily strong. Mm-hmm. And in the eyes of the anti-war movement, which was maybe a little bit more left-oriented, Johnson was if not a villain, I may be overstating it, but Johnson was the a poor leader. And so there was a lot of criticism of Johnson. And I think one of the reasons why Johnson, only maybe 40, 50 years later, started getting kind of fairer assessments is this predisposition of many people my age that grew up during that period of time that, Johnson represented a problem and represented a very conservative view of society and efforts to try to manipulate society. So there was a very, I think that, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. So I think there was some criticism. But it's also the case that he didn't get to do what he wanted. And fair housing is really a good example of this. This was one of the last pieces of legislation focused on discrimination in housing markets and ensuring everybody has a proper place to live. Johnson understood how important housing and poverty were, how much how they were so intertwined. And the housing bill that was passed was very much of a compromise, and there was really no serious enforcement mechanism for the Fair Housing Act. And this has persisted. And so one of the problems that we face today is that similar piece of legislation back in 1968 has not done its job, has not done what was expected and what needs to be done. So this is an instance where Johnson deserves criticism. He was in charge, but he did aspire for more and didn't make it. And this is one of those areas where there was never a national consensus around that topic to strengthen the Fair Housing Act.
All right, we'll take the discussion toward our current era after a break. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Welcome back to Dialogue. Now going into our final segment on this Wednesday afternoon, the topic is the Great Society then and now. We spent most of the program talking about then with a little bit of now. We're going to switch gears a little bit and go into the now. Our guests, if you're just joining us, are Aaron Astor, an associate professor of history at Maryville College, who teaches a course on the 1960s and the cultural and political shifts of that era. And joining us on the phone from Connecticut is Bob Wilson. He works at the University of Connecticut and was the co-editor of a 2015 book called LBJ's Neglected Legacy. Bob, I want to start this third portion of the program here with you. As we start to shift in, the most immediate after Johnson, president, of course, was Nixon, came in early 1969, 50 years ago this year. And these days, we're really used to the idea that one of the president's first tasks is undoing some of the things his predecessor did. We've seen this in a lot of the pendulum swing administrations. If a Democratic administration comes in after a Republican, or vice versa. And so I expected when I started doing the homework for this show that would be the case, that Nixon would start going in and job one and start dismantling some of these programs supported by his unpopular, at that point, predecessor. That didn't happen, and as Dr. Astor has alluded to, he even built on some of those programs and expanded them or gave them more detail. Why did that happen that way?
A couple of things. I think there are instances, plenty of instances where Nixon was trying to undermine efforts. You know, the Model Cities program was kind of on its last leg anyway, but he put the kibosh on it. And also in the voting rights, he had the Department of Justice really pull back on voting rights, not changing legislation. So there's some administrative things that Nixon did. He did have a, run on a platform that's really quite different. And tried to decentralize authority to state governments. So this, you see, it's not a dramatic change, but it is something that's more consistent with the philosophy of the Republican Party. But another, I think that one of the really interesting things is in the environmental policy, where under Nixon, environmental policy legislation was passed. It is really significant, the creation of EPA. Some of these things had been started under Johnson, but I think even at that point, the Republican, there were members of there were strong environmentalists in the Republican Party at that point in time. So that was not too surprising. The one that I think is a little bit more surprising is his experiment with a guaranteed family income. It was an experiment done in New Jersey, and guaranteed family income is certainly not what you would associate with the Republican Party, but he was the one actually that experimented with it. And there are a lot of people, both conservative and liberal, that say there's merit to that idea. So it is kind of a mixed picture. But Nixon was certainly no advocate of strong voting rights and civil rights. And this may not be as quite as visible. So I understand why somebody might come away with the conclusion that Nixon was there just kind of polishing off or renaming some of the things that Johnson did. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a little bit more to it than that.
Well, you mentioned, Dr. Astor, that Ronald Reagan was on the record as opposing some of the Great Society programs, particularly like Medicare, as early as the mid-1960s, when his political career at that time was still, he was running for governor of California. This is long before the White House. But he held on to those ideas and developed them some so that when he was president in the 1980s, in one speech in 1983, he called the Great Society the central political error of our time. But even he did not dismantle the programs wholesale. What happened during his administration? Changes to those programs, or why they stayed at least with us on the books?
Well, of course, you know, he was limited to how much power he had to undermine these things. I mean, if he could have, he probably would have undermined more. And it speaks to the importance of the fact that these acts of legislation were, in fact, acts of legislation and not executive orders. President Johnson did not create Medicare by an executive order. He did not create these wilderness protection plans by executive order. These were acts of Congress. And so he could, as Bob mentioned, he could shift, he could, you know, downplay or lower enforcement mechanisms for mm-hmm. Voting Rights Act, for example. And certainly Reagan did that quite a bit throughout the 1980s, or reshuffling priorities. The drug war, you know, drug policy stuff, which did begin with Johnson and were dramatically escalated by Nixon and Reagan, mm-hmm. Which was, you know, relied on a mass, large scale expansion of the federal government role. But Reagan, you know, there was a limit to what he could actually do. I mean, in the 1970s, you have think tanks like the Heritage Foundation that are going through policy by policy of how they can, what's wrong with them from the conservative perspective and how they can dismantle them. And then Reagan comes into office, and there's a lot of expectations that he's going to dismantle all of this, and some of it he does. Some certainly appoints justices, judges and judges of the courts that are going to try to limit the administrative power of this. But again, he's limited because the laws are, they are robust by that point. There are some laws that he vetoes and that are overridden. The Clean Air Act, 1982, for example. You know, he is, in fact, just simply, he's outvoted. But there's a limit to how much he can actually do to roll back a lot of these laws.
Yeah. The message, yeah, though. Think, oh, yeah, go ahead.
One example where he made a little bit more progress, and the federal involvement in cities and urban policy really reached its heights with Johnson, and then was on the decline, and particularly with Reagan. Reagan felt that the federal government should not be involved in cities at all. And I think during his time, there was cutbacks in housing and urban development. If I'm not mistaken, he tried to do away with the agency. But agencies, federal policies, as you suggested, they become entrenched, and it's extremely hard to change things, as President Trump is discovering, I suppose.
Well, and the limitations of any president's power. Johnson himself was frustrated that he could not do more, or that he had to go through Congress, which, as his administration went on, became more and more recalcitrant in carrying out these expensive kind of programs that Johnson still had in mind and still wanted to accomplish before he left office. So I guess they've all gotten a taste of that medicine over the years. I want to talk a little bit about some of the modern evolution of what's going on. As we talked about, these programs are not necessarily set in stone. They are hard to dismantle, but not entirely impossible. As recently as a couple of years ago, Republicans in Congress were still talking about radically changing Medicaid and Medicare, the way they're funded, the size and scope. And even this year in Tennessee, the legislature is going to petition the governor to ask for Medicaid to be switched over to a block grant format. It's a different way of funding the program, which we had not seen and no state has done yet. So what would you say, Dr. Astor, we can begin with you, are some of the greatest challenges to the legislation as we sit here in 2019?
Well, the challenges are the fact that the issues that this legislation was trying to address are still with us, as we've said before. I mean, healthcare is a great example. Health insurance, national health insurance has been something that American politicians from Teddy Roosevelt on down have been pushing for well over 100 years with mixed success. Some of the greatest expansions happened almost by accident. I mean, World War II, to get around some of the wage rationing, you started to see Kaiser and these various companies creating essentially employer-based health insurance programs, which is now what most people, I think a majority of people, get their health insurance from that. So now when you have these discussions about altering the health insurance system, we have this hodgepodge system. We have Medicare, we have Medicaid, which has been expanded through the ACA. We have the various veterans care programs. And then you have this private system, which is still primarily done group-based through employers. And it's, how do you address the holes in there? Mm-hmm. How do you address the people who are not without, and as you've seen this with the Democratic primary, how do you address it without overturning what other people have come to be comfortable with? Yeah. And that's, you know, the problem, as both parties have discovered with healthcare policies, the Democrats discovered, much of their chagrin in 2010, is that when you alter the existing, it becomes, people are terrified, and it becomes a political cudgel. But then the Republicans discovered in 2018 that, as unpopular as something might have been initially, once people become adjusted to it, then trying to eliminate it is itself unpopular. And so healthcare is such a big part of the economy, it's so central to people's lives. And, you know, Tennessee is an example of a state that never expanded Medicaid. This block grant thing is that, you know, something that conservatives pushed for decades. But it's a, you know, you're seeing these pushes in various different ideological directions that who knows what's going to end up happening to, because the law is written pretty robustly, and it's hard to, there's only so much that states can do, you know, to alter it, even if, whether they have good or bad ideas.
And that's an important point to make, is that the Medicaid block grant idea is not just something the state legislature could vote on and the governor signs into law. They still have to ask the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services.
And then courts
in
have
Washington.
To weigh in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there could be legal challenges, of course. Bob, I want to turn that same question to you. What do you think are some of the biggest changes that might be on the horizon? I hesitate to use the word threats, but I mean just changes that could come along the way, or ways in which Great Society legislation is currently being discussed as a possibility for change.
Good. Before I want to talk about voting rights and immigration, but before I do that, just one other element to supplement the discussion of Medicare, Medicaid, health policy in general. We cannot overlook the power of the primary economic actors and forces at work, many of which are private. You look at the insurance company, you look at hospitals, the medical association, the drug makers, other kinds of service providers. It is a very, very deeply entrenched system that's built around the incentives that are currently offered. And so great resistance, and it's almost impossible to imagine different kinds of policies where all those interests would be certainly not, you can optimize all their interests, but even make them sufficiently compatible that you can make change. So this is one of the things that was remarkable, that Obama was able to achieve anything given the strength of the economic forces around it. But I think one of the really interesting topics in today's world to think about is tied up to kind of immigration, the changing multicultural society that we're in, and Voting Rights Act. The immigration policy that Johnson passed was almost an accident. We were still living under the nativist immigration policy established in the 1920s, where immigration was only allowed from kind of Western European countries, all over state, just a little bit, but essentially that was it. And Johnson was feeling the pressure of the Soviet competition, the Cold War, and it was just it reduced our credibility to have essentially a racist immigration policy when we're trying to nurture countries in South America and Africa and Asia to be our allies against the Soviets. And so this is one of the motivations. There was a timely death of a congressman had been in the way, and the immigration policy was changed, and not really noticed very much, not very important. But in fact, that policy has changed the racial, ethnic, demographic composition of this country. We now have a higher share of non-native-born people in the country since 1910, I believe. So it's changed the face. Also, it's changed the face of who we consider minority status. For a long period of time, African Americans was the primary group. Now we have a multitude of groups that are kind of in similar situations that may experience discrimination. So the politics now is really much more complicated of that, and seems to be no consensus on changing what our immigration policy is. And this dovetails with voting rights. And you may recall the famous adage that when LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act, he said he's giving the South to the Republican Party for the next 50 years. Well, 50 years is up. And you think about some of the changes. Now, a lot of it's kind of driven by the growth of the African-American population, but you have other minority groups now. And the voting, you know, there's been a court decision that undermined part of the Voting Rights Act. So this is really a critical thing to watch. Given the diversity in our country, our political system is not going to work well unless we figure out how to make sure that voting is free and easily accessible to everybody. And you see this conflict right now in the state of Georgia, where we find as states garner more discretion in defining voting law, You can expect more instances where groups are, if you don't like the word voter suppression, you do find certain groups being, it's harder for them to be able to exercise a franchise.
Okay, so, Bob, I'm going to cut you right there. We're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. Bob Wilson of the University of Connecticut, co-editor of the book LBJ's Neglected Legacy. Thank you so much. Aaron Astor, professor of history at Maryville College. And you've been listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Thanks for joining us.